Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to unpack complex stories and really get into the heart of things. And today, well, we're diving into a baseball legend. But first, let's think about nicknames for a second. You know, the really famous ones?
Oh, yeah, like Air Jordan for Michael Jordan.
Exactly. Or the GOAT for Tom Brady, Iron Mike Tyson. They instantly paint a picture, don't they?
They absolutely do. They capture something essential.
And it's not just superstar athletes. Maybe you've got a friend you nicknamed or, you know, a celebrity where the name just clicks perfectly. So why do we give nicknames? Is it like a physical thing, a special skill maybe?
Or sometimes a specific moment, something memorable that just sticks.
Yeah. And baseball, wow, it's full of them.
Oh, definitely. Baseball history is rich with nicknames. Think about Babe Ruth or Charlie Hustle for Pete Rose.
The Wizard, Ozzie Smith. You hear the name, you instantly know something about them.
Precisely. It's like a brand almost.
So here's a thought for you. What comes to mind if you hear someone's nicknamed the Bull?
The Bull. Probably powerful, right? Maybe tough.
Unstoppable, maybe. Determined.
Yeah, all of that. Which brings us perfectly to today's subject. The legendary Dodgers pitcher, Fernando Valenzuela.
Ah, Fernando.
He was known as El Toro, the Bull in Spanish.
Right, El Toro. And that obviously points to his Mexican heritage.
It does, but it quickly became so much more. It really started to represent his incredible toughness, his determination, that quiet resolve he had.
So that's our mission for this deep dive. Yeah. We want to explore Fernando's amazing journey, you know, trace it from his really humble start all the way to becoming this global icon.
And really look at how he embodied those bull-like qualities.
Exactly. And the cultural impact he had, which honestly went way, way beyond baseball.
It really did. It's quite a story. And it starts in a very small place, at Choaquila, Mexico.
Tiny place, right.
Incredibly small. Born November 1st, 1960. He was one of 12 kids. And when we say humble beginnings,
we really mean it.
Yeah. Dirt roads, potholes, no running water. The population in 2020 was still only about 850 people. That's where he came from.
It's hard to even picture, but descriptions of him, even as a kid, they say he was calm, quiet, but also
very confident and intelligent. That's what stands out. And unflappable, even back then.
Unflappable. That fits the Bull image, doesn't it?
It really does. And he was good, fast. Playing pro ball in Mexico for Guanajuato when he was just 17.
17? And how long did it take for the big leagues to notice?
Not long at all. Within a year of that pro debut, MLB scouts were definitely paying attention.
So who found him?
That would be the legendary Cuban-American scout, Mike Brito. He saw Fernando playing for the Leones de Yucatan in 78.
And the Dodgers moved fast.
They did. Signed him July 6, 1979. He was only 18. They paid $120,000 and apparently just beat the Yankees to him.
Wow. Close call. So the Dodgers got their guy, and they sent him to the minors, right? Lodi, San Antonio.
Yep. Needed that development time. Class A in Lodi, Double A in San Antonio. Standard stuff.
But then came the winter of 79. Something pretty crucial happened then.
Ah, yes. That's when he learned the pitch. His signature weapon.
The screwball.
The screwball. Taught to him by another Dodgers pitcher, Bobby Castillo. Mike Brito actually urged Castillo to teach him.
And what made the screwball so special?
Well, it breaks the opposite way to a curveball. It's really deceptive, and almost nobody threw it effectively back then. It made Fernando instantly unique, a puzzle for hitters.
A dangerous new weapon, some called it. Almost mystical.
Absolutely. It just baffled major league hitters. Earl Hershiser, his teammate later on, said it was high risk, but...
But Fernando knew what he was doing.
Exactly. He had this amazing feel for it, incredible control.
And you saw that control pretty much immediately when he got called up.
Oh, yeah. September 1980. Makes his debut on the 15th as a reliever.
And
proceeds to allow zero earned runs. None. Over 10 games, nearly 18 innings. Just scoreless baseball.
That's more than a glimpse. That's like a neon sign pointing to what's coming.
It really was. A taste of the phenomena. Because that glimpse, it exploded into something huge the very next season.
1981, opening day. He wasn't even supposed to start, right?
Nope. Jerry Reese gets injured. Fernando's just 20 years old. And manager Tommy Lasorda literally has to wake him up from a nap to tell him he's starting opening day.
You can't make this stuff up. And that decision, that basically kicked off Fernando Mania.
It absolutely did. And Fernando Mania wasn't just hype. It was real.
Yeah.
He won his first 8 starts.
8 straight wins to start his rookie season.
8 straight. And get this, 7 were complete games. 5 were shutouts.
Shutouts. That just dominant.
Utterly dominant.
Yeah.
In that stretch, 72 innings, he struck out 68 batters, allowed only 4 earned runs. His ERA was
0.50. 0.50. That's basically video game numbers.
Pretty much unheard of, especially for a rookie under that kind of sudden pressure.
And that connects right back to El Toro, doesn't it? That bull-like toughness. Unflappable.
Completely. There's that story, right? He gives up his first homer and apparently just shrugs it off. His next 18 pitches, all strikes.
Wow. That's mental strength. That's focus.
Beyond the numbers, though, his style was just mesmerizing.
Oh, the windup? Everyone remembers the windup.
That high leg kick looking up towards the sky?
Yeah.
It's iconic. One of the most famous deliveries ever.
People said his eyes rolled back in his head sometimes during it.
Yeah, there were those descriptions. And some people saw, like, a spiritual element, too.
Mm-hmm.
The National Catholic Reporter noted it looked like the sign of the cross.
Interesting. Adds another layer to the whole phenomenon.
And through all this chaos and attention, for a 20-year-old kid, he was just remarkably calm, confident.
That poise, combined with the skill, it made 1981 unforgettable.
Totally. He gets picked for the All-Star game.
As the starter for the National League, as a rookie.
Incredible. He finishes that season, which was shortened by a strike, 13-7, 2.48 ERA. Great numbers.
But then came the awards and history.
Right. He becomes the first player ever to win Rookie of the Year and the Cy Young Award in the same season.
Just think about that. Best newcomer and best pitcher in the entire league simultaneously.
It's stunning and shows just how immediate and massive his impact was.
And he would hit, too. Won the Silver Slugger Award for pitchers.
Yeah, which is pretty rare for a pitcher. Yep. Shows his overall baseball smarts.
And then the World Series. 1981, Dodgers versus Yankees.
And he was crucial. Game 3, a huge game. He pitched a complete game through something like 147 pitches.
A marathon effort.
Gut-wrenching, they called it. Dodgers won 5-4. Many people point to that game as the moment the series turned in the Dodgers' favor.
So he wasn't just a flash in the pan. This wasn't a one-year wonder.
Oh, not at all. He was an all-star for 6 straight years, from 81 to 86.
Consistent excellence.
He won 141 games over 11 years with the Dodgers, which is still 8th most in their history.
And think about that peak period, 81 to 87.
Right. During those years, he won more games than any other starting pitcher in the National League.
Or more than anyone. Wow.
Yeah. And his ERA, his earned run average, was second best among guys who pitched a lot of innings.
Hmm.
Only Nolan Ryan was better.
Nolan Ryan? That's legendary company.
And here's a crazy stat. During that same period, Fernando actually struck out more batters than Nolan Ryan did.
Get it out of here. More strikeouts than Ryan during his prime years.
Yep. It speaks to his dominance and his durability, initially at least, 6 straight seasons pitching over 250 innings.
That's just, you'll never see that again in today's game. Managers wouldn't allow it.
Absolutely not. The workload was immense. And he capped it off later with a no-hitter in 1990 against the Cardinals.
A no-hitter too. Okay, so the baseball achievements are undeniable. But the real story of El Toro, the deeper impact, that goes beyond the stats, right?
It absolutely does. You have to understand the context in Los Angeles at the time.
The Chavez Ravine situation.
Exactly. Building Dodger Stadium involved displacing Mexican-American families. It created this deep, decades-long resentment in the community.
A real wound.
A huge wound. And the Dodgers owner, Walter O'Malley, he actually said he wanted a Mexican Sandy Koufax, someone who could bridge that gap, connect with the city's huge Latino population.
And then along comes Fernando.
Unexpectedly. He became that balm, as some called it. He started to heal those old wounds just by being who he was.
So he wasn't just playing baseball. He was actively mending fences, building bridges.
Unintentionally, perhaps, but yes. He became this incredibly powerful symbol of hope. The American dream, you know?
Huh?
Especially for Latinos and Mexican Americans who felt marginalized. He gave them someone to root for, someone who looked like them, succeeding on the biggest stage.
And the response was just electric. Fernando mania.
Off the charts. His starts were events. Sellouts at home in 81. On the road, attendance would jump by like 13,000 people when Fernando pitched.
13,000 extra fans just to see him pitch. That's incredible, Paul.
The Dodgers broke the overall MLB attendance record in 82, 3.6 million fans. And think about the media reach.
Right, the radio broadcasts.
Went from 3 stations in Mexico carrying Dodgers games to 17. And the Spanish broadcasts here in the U.S., they had more than double the listeners of Vin Scully's English broadcast.
More than Vin Scully. Wow. That shows the connection.
It really does. And you saw it in the stands, too. Latino attendance at Dodger Stadium reportedly went from maybe 8% before him
yeah.
to nearly 30% in the mid-80s, and kept climbing 42% by 2005. He literally changed the face of the crowd at Dodger Stadium.
He made it a place where that community felt truly welcome.
Exactly. He made it their team in a way it hadn't been before.
And he became more than just a player. He was a genuine cultural icon.
Totally. Covers of Sports Illustrated, The Unreal, covered the sporting news, everything.
He met President Reagan at the White House.
Yep, attended a state luncheon. There are even stories that meeting Fernando influenced Reagan's thinking on immigration reform later. Hard to verify, but it shows his reach.
Kellogg's Corn Flakes box, that's mainstream fame right there.
Tribute songs like Fernando, El Toro by Lalo and Mark Guerrero, he was everywhere.
But through it all, he remained kind of private, right? Reserved?
Yeah, very much so. He said himself, I'm someone who is very reserved. I always think twice about what I want to do or say. And crucially, he added, I knew I was representing Mexico to many people.
That sense of responsibility, that humility despite the craziness.
It's remarkable. He handled the pressure with such grace.
And there was that spiritual side people connected with too, the religious symbols in his locker.
Right. La Virgen de Guadalupe, El Santo Niño. And that wound up being compared to the sign of the cross.
Someone called his story biblical.
It had that feel for a lot of people, this unexpected, almost miraculous rise.
Of course, that incredible workload, the screwball, it eventually caught up with him.
Sadly, yes. Shoulder problems really started to affect him. He missed a lot of time in 1988.
And then the Dodgers released him in 91. That caused a huge uproar.
It really did. It felt like a betrayal to many fans, a cold business move after everything he'd given the team and the city.
But true to that bull spirit, he didn't just quit baseball.
No way.
Yeah.
He kept pitching until 1997, playing for several other teams, showed that determination again.
And eventually he came back home, in a way.
He did. Returned to the Dodgers organization in 2003 as a Spanish language radio commentator.
And he's been doing that for over 20 years now, right? Still connecting with fans.
Still a beloved voice. He also became a U.S. citizen in 2015, which felt like another chapter closing in a really nice way.
And the honors kept coming. Halls of Fame in Mexico, the Caribbean, California, Mexico's highest sports award.
His number 34 is retired by the Mexican League. And finally, thankfully, by the Dodgers in 2023.
That Dodgers retirement felt long overdue to many.
It absolutely did. Huge celebration. There's even a statue of him in Guadalajara.
Now, the Cooperstown debate, the MLB Hall of Fame, it's tricky.
It is. His peak was incredibly high, but the longevity, partly due to the arm issues from overuse, means his overall career stats are maybe slightly above average by Hall standards. He fell off the writer's ballot.
Can you really measure his importance just by stats?
That's the whole point, isn't it? His cultural significance, his impact on the Dodgers, on Los Angeles, on bridging communities, that's undeniable. It goes so far beyond wins and losses or ERA. He got the Dodgers back on track with a huge part of their fan base.
So wrapping this up, what are the big takeaways? Thinking about El Toro, about Fernando, those bull-like qualities.
The toughness, absolutely. But also the quiet courage, the determination. And maybe above all, the humility.
Holding on to that humility through the whirlwind of Fernando Mania, that's maybe the most impressive thing.
I think so, too. Those traits weren't just about winning baseball games. They were about how he handled fame, how he carried the hopes of a community, how he stayed true to himself under immense pressure.
He always wanted to give the fans a good show, but he stayed very reserved, as he put it.
Never let the fame change his core.
So that nickname, El Toro, the Bull, it started maybe as a physical thing about strength.
Probably.
Yeah.
It came to mean so much more. It symbolized that deeper legacy, the cultural impact, the quiet strength, the unwavering dedication. His story is just such a powerful example of how one person, through their talent, yes, but also through their character, can genuinely galvanize a generation, change perceptions, and even heal divides between a team and its community. His power wasn't just on the mound. It was in the lasting inspiration he gave.